Inclusive economic institutions also tend to reduce the benefits the elites can enjoy by ruling over extractive political institutions, since those institutions face competition in the marketplace and are constrained by the contracts and property rights of the rest of society. Why not always choose prosperity? Political and economic institutions, which are ultimately the choice of society, can be inclusive and encourage economic growth, or they can be extractive and become impediments to economic growth. Nations fail when they have extractive economic institutions, supported by extractive political institutions that impede and even block economic growth. But this means that the choice of institutions, that is, the politics of institutions, is central to our quest for understanding the reasons for the success and failure of nations. We have to understand why the politics of some societies lead to inclusive institutions that foster economic growth, while the politics of the vast majority of societies throughout history has led, and still leads today, to extractive institutions that hamper economic growth. It might seem obvious that everyone should have an interest in creating the type of economic institutions that will bring prosperity. Wouldn't every citizen, every politician, and even a predatory dictator want to make his country as wealthy as possible? Let's return to the Kingdom of Congo we discussed earlier. Though this kingdom collapsed in the 17th century, it provided the name for the modern country that became independent from Belgian colonial rule in 1960. As an independent polity, Congo experienced almost unbroken economic decline and mounting poverty under the rule of Joseph Mobutu between 1965 and 1997. The decline continued after Mobutu was overthrown by Laurent Kabila. Mobutu created a highly extractive set of economic institutions. The citizens were impoverished, but Mobutu and the elite surrounding him, known as les gros légumes, the big vegetables, became fabulously wealthy. Mobutu built himself a palace at his birthplace, Gabaroli, in the north of the country, with an airport large enough to land a supersonic Concorde jet, a plane he frequently rented from Air France for travel to Europe. In Europe, he bought castles and owned large tracts of the Belgian capital of Brussels. Wouldn't it have been better for Mobutu to set up economic institutions that increased the wealth of the Congolese rather than deepening their poverty? If Mobutu had managed to increase the prosperity of his nation, would he not have been able to appropriate even more money, buy a Concorde instead of renting one, have more castles and mansions, possibly a bigger and more powerful army? Unfortunately for the citizens of many countries in the world, the answer is no. Economic institutions that create incentives for economic progress may simultaneously redistribute income and power in such a way that a predatory dictator and others with political power may become worse off. The fundamental problem is that there will necessarily be disputes and conflict over economic institutions. Different institutions have different consequences for the prosperity of a nation, how that prosperity is distributed, and who has the power. The economic growth which can be induced by institutions creates both winners and losers. This was clear during the Industrial Revolution in England, which laid the foundations of the prosperity we see in the rich countries of the world today. It centered on a series of path-breaking technological changes in steam power, transportation, and textile production. Even though mechanization led to enormous increases in total incomes and ultimately became the foundation of modern industrial society, it was bitterly opposed by many. Not because of ignorance or short-sightedness, quite the opposite. Rather, such opposition to economic growth has its own, unfortunately coherent logic. Economic growth and technological change are accompanied by what the great economist Joseph Schumpeter called creative destruction. They replace the old with the new. New sectors attract resources away from the old ones. New firms take business away from established ones. New technologies make existing skills and machines obsolete. The process of economic growth and the inclusive institutions upon which it is based create losers as well as winners in the political arena and in the economic marketplace. Fear of creative destruction is often at the root of the opposition to inclusive economic and political institutions. European history provides a vivid example of the consequences of creative destruction. On the eve of the Industrial Revolution in the 18th century, the governments of most European countries were controlled by aristocracies and traditional elites, whose major source of income was from land holdings or from trading privileges they enjoyed thanks to monopolies granted and entry barriers imposed by monarchs. Consistent with the idea of creative destruction, the spread of industries, factories, and towns took resources away from the land, reduced land rents, and increased the wages that landowners had to pay their workers. These elites also saw the emergence of new businessmen and merchants eroding their trading privileges. All in all, they were the clear economic losers from industrialization. Urbanization and the emergence of a socially conscious middle and working class also challenged the political monopoly of landed aristocracies. So with the spread of the Industrial Revolution, the aristocracies weren't just the economic losers. They also risked becoming political losers, losing their hold on political power. With their economic and political power under threat, these elites often formed a formidable opposition against industrialization. The aristocracy was not the only loser from industrialization. Artisans, whose manual skills were being replaced by mechanization, likewise opposed the spread of industry. Many organized against it, rioting and destroying the machines they saw as responsible for the decline of their livelihood. They were the Luddites, a word that has today become synonymous with resistance to technological change. John Kay, English inventor of the flying shuttle in 1733, one of the first significant improvements in the mechanization of weaving, had his house burned down by Luddites in 1753. James Hargreaves, inventor of the spinning jenny, a complementary revolutionary improvement in spinning, got similar treatment. In reality, the artisans were much less effective than the landowners and elites in opposing industrialization. The Luddites did not possess the political power, the ability to affect political outcomes against the wishes of other groups of the landed aristocracy. In England, industrialization marched on, despite the Luddites' opposition, because aristocratic opposition, though real, was muted. In the Austro-Hungarian and the Russian empires, where the absolutist monarchs and aristocrats had far more to lose, industrialization was blocked. In consequence, the economies of Austria-Hungary and Russia stalled. They fell behind other European nations, where economic growth took off during the 19th century. The success and failure of specific groups notwithstanding, one lesson is clear. Powerful groups often stand against economic progress and against the engines of prosperity. Economic growth is not just a process of more and better machines and more and better educated people, but also a transformative and destabilizing process associated with widespread creative destruction. Growth thus moves forward only if not blocked by the economic losers who anticipate that their economic privileges will be lost, and by the political losers who fear that their political power will be eroded. Conflict over scarce resources, income, and power translates into conflict over the rules of the game, the economic institutions, which will determine the economic activities and who will benefit from them. When there is a conflict, the wishes of all parties cannot be simultaneously met. Some will be defeated and frustrated, while others will succeed in securing outcomes they like. Who the winners of this conflict are has fundamental implications for a nation's economic trajectory. If the groups standing against growth are the winners, they can successfully block economic growth, and the economy will stagnate. The logic of why the powerful would not necessarily want to set up the economic institutions that promote economic success extends easily to the choice of political institutions. In an absolutist regime, some elites can wield power to set up economic institutions they prefer. Would they be interested in changing political institutions to make them more pluralistic? In general, not, since this would only dilute their political power, making it more difficult, maybe impossible for them, to structure economic institutions to further their own interests. Here again, we see a ready source of conflict. The people who suffer from the extractive economic institutions cannot hope for absolutist rulers to voluntarily change political institutions and redistribute power in society. The only way to change these political institutions is to force the elite to create more pluralistic institutions. In the same way that there is no reason why political institutions should automatically become pluralistic, there is no natural tendency toward political centralization. There would certainly be incentives to create more centralized state institutions in any society, particularly in those with no such centralization whatsoever. For example, in Somalia, if one clan created a centralized state capable of imposing order on the country, this could lead to economic benefits and make this clan richer. What stops this? The main barrier to political centralization is, again, a form of fear from change. Any clan, group, or politician attempting to centralize power in the state will also be centralizing power in their own hands, and this is likely to meet the ire of other clans, groups, and individuals who would be the political losers of this process. Lack of political centralization means not only lack of law and order in much of a territory, but also there being many actors with sufficient powers to block or disrupt things, and the fear of their opposition and violent reaction will often deter many would-be centralizers. Political centralization is likely only when one group of people is sufficiently more powerful than others to build a state. In Somalia, power is evenly balanced, and no one clan can impose its will on any other. Therefore, the lack of political centralization persists. The long agony of the Congo. There are few better or more depressing examples of the forces that explain the logic of why economic prosperity is so persistently rare under extractive institutions, or that illustrate the synergy between extractive economic and political institutions, than the Congo. Portuguese and Dutch visitors to Congo in the 15th and 16th centuries remarked on the miserable poverty there. Technology was rudimentary by European standards, with the Congolese having neither writing, the wheel, nor the plow. The reason for this poverty, and the reluctance of Congolese farmers to adopt better technologies when they learned of them, is clear from existing historical accounts. It was due to the extractive nature of the country's economic institutions. As we have seen, the Kingdom of Congo was governed by the king in Mbanza, subsequently São Salvador. Areas away from the capital were ruled by an elite who played the roles of governors of different parts of the kingdom. The wealth of this elite was based on slave plantations around São Salvador and the extraction of taxes from the rest of the country. Slavery was central to the economy, used by the elite to supply their own plantations and by Europeans on the coast. Taxes were arbitrary. One tax was even collected every time the king's beret fell off. To become more prosperous, the Congolese people would have had to save and invest, for example by buying plows, but it would not have been worthwhile, since any extra output that they produced using better technology would have been subject to expropriation by the king and his elite. Instead of investing to increase their productivity and selling their products in markets, the Congolese moved their villages away from the market. They were trying to be as far away from the roads as possible, in order to reduce the incidence of plunder and to escape the reach of slave traders. The poverty of the Congo was therefore the result of extractive economic institutions that blocked all the engines of prosperity, or even made them work in reverse. The Congo's government provided very few public services to its citizens, not even basic ones, such as secure property rights or law and order. On the contrary, the government was itself the biggest threat to its subjects' property and human rights. The institution of slavery meant that the most fundamental market of all, an inclusive labor market, where people can choose their occupation or jobs in ways that are so crucial for a prosperous economy, did not exist. Moreover, long-distance trade and mercantile activities were controlled by the king, and were open only to those associated with him. Though the elite quickly became literate after the Portuguese introduced writing, the king made no attempt to spread literacy to the great mass of the population. Nevertheless, though miserable poverty was widespread, the Congolese extractive institutions had their own impeccable logic. They made a few people, those with political power, very rich. In the 16th century, the King of Congo and the aristocracy were able to import European luxury goods and were surrounded by servants and slaves. The roots of the economic institutions of Congolese society flowed from the distribution of political power in society, and thus from the nature of political institutions. There was nothing to stop the king from taking people's possessions or bodies, other than the threat of revolt. Though this threat was real, it was not enough to make people or their wealth secure. The political institutions of Congo were truly absolutist, making the king and the elite subject to essentially no constraints, and it gave no say to the citizens in the way their society was organized. Of course, it is not difficult to see that the political institutions of Congo contrast sharply with inclusive political institutions, where power is constrained and broadly distributed. The absolutist institutions of Congo were kept in place by the army. The king had a standing army of 5,000 troops in the mid-17th century, with a corps of 500 musketeers, a formidable force for its time. Why the king and the aristocracy so eagerly adopted European firearms is thus easy to understand. There was no chance of sustained economic growth under this set of economic institutions, and even incentives for generating temporary growth were highly limited. Reforming economic institutions to improve individual property rights would have made the Congolese society at large more prosperous, but it is unlikely that the elite would have benefited from this wider prosperity. First, such reforms would have made the elite economic losers by undermining the wealth that the slave trade and slave plantations brought them. Second, such reforms would have been possible only if the political power of the king and the elite were curtailed. For instance, if the king continued to command his 500 musketeers, who would have believed an announcement that slavery had been abolished? What would have stopped the king from changing his mind later on? The only real guarantee would have been a change in political institutions, so that citizens gained some countervailing political power, giving them some say over taxation or what the musketeers did. But in this case, it is dubious that sustaining the consumption and lifestyle of the king and the elite would have been high on their list of priorities. In this scenario, changes that would have created better economic institutions in society would have made the king and aristocracy political as well as economic losers. The interaction of economic and political institutions 500 years ago is still relevant for understanding why the modern state of Congo is still miserably poor today. The advent of European rule in this area, and deeper into the basin of the River Congo at the time of the scramble for Africa in the late 19th century, led to an insecurity of human and property rights even more egregious than that which characterized the pre-colonial Congo. In addition, it reproduced the pattern of extractive institutions and political absolutism that empowered and enriched a few at the expense of the masses, though the few now were Belgian colonists, most notably King Leopold II. When Congo became independent in 1960, the same pattern of economic institutions, incentives, and performance reproduced itself. These Congolese extractive economic institutions were again supported by highly extractive political institutions. The situation was worsened because European colonialism created a polity, Congo, made up of many different pre-colonial states and societies that the national state, run from Kinshasa, had little control over. Though President Mobutu used the state to enrich himself and his cronies, for example, through the Zaireanization program of 1973, which involved the mass expropriation of foreign economic interests, he presided over a non-centralized state with little authority over much of the country, and had to appeal to foreign assistance to stop the provinces of Katanga and Kasai from seceding in the 1960s. This lack of political centralization, almost to the point of total collapse of the state, is a feature that Congo shares with much of sub-Saharan Africa. The modern Democratic Republic of Congo remains poor because its citizens still lack the economic institutions that create the basic incentives that make a society prosperous. It is not geography, culture, or the ignorance of its citizens or politicians that keep the Congo poor, but its extractive economic institutions. These are still in place after all these centuries because political power continues to be narrowly concentrated in the hands of an elite who have little incentive to enforce secure property rights for the people, to provide the basic public services that would improve the quality of life, or to encourage economic progress. Rather, their interests are to extract income and sustain their power. They have not used this power to build a centralized state, for to do so would create the same problems of opposition and political challenges that promoting economic growth would. Moreover, as in much of the rest of sub-Saharan Africa, infighting triggered by rival groups attempting to take control of extractive institutions destroyed any tendency for state centralization that might have existed. The history of the Kingdom of Congo and the more recent history of the Congo vividly illustrates how political institutions determine economic institutions, and through these, the economic incentives and the scope for economic growth. It also illustrates the symbiotic relationship between political absolutism and economic institutions that empower and enrich a few at the expense of many. Growth under extractive political institutions. Congo today is an extreme example, with lawlessness and highly insecure property rights. However, in most cases, such extremism would not serve the interest of the elite, since it would destroy all economic incentives and generate few resources to be extracted. The central thesis of this book is that economic growth and prosperity are associated with inclusive economic and political institutions, while extractive institutions typically lead to stagnation and poverty. But this implies neither that extractive institutions can never generate growth, nor that all extractive institutions are created equal. There are two distinct but complementary ways in which growth under extractive political institutions can emerge. First, even if economic institutions are extractive, growth is possible when elites can directly allocate resources to high productivity activities that they themselves control. A prominent example of this type of growth under extractive institutions was the Caribbean islands between the 16th and 18th centuries. Most people were slaves, working under gruesome conditions in plantations, living barely above subsistence level. Many died from malnutrition and exhaustion. In Barbados, Cuba, Haiti, and Jamaica in the 17th and 18th centuries, a small minority, the planter elite, controlled all political power and owned all the assets, including all the slaves. While the majority had no rights, the planter's elite's property and assets were well protected. Despite the extractive economic institutions that savagely exploited the majority of the population, these islands were among the richest places in the world because they could produce sugar and sell it in world markets. The economy of the islands stagnated only when there was a need to shift to new economic activities, which threatened both the incomes and the political power of the planter elite. Another example is the economic growth and industrialization of the Soviet Union from the first five-year plan in 1928 until the 1970s. Political and economic institutions were highly extractive, and markets were heavily constrained. Nevertheless, the Soviet Union was able to achieve rapid economic growth because it could use the power of the state to move resources from agriculture, where they were very inefficiently used, into industry. The second type of growth under extractive political institutions arises when the institutions permit the development of somewhat, even if not completely, inclusive economic institutions. Many societies with extractive political institutions will shy away from inclusive economic institutions because of fear of creative destruction. But the degree to which the elite manage to monopolize power varies across societies. In some, the position of the elite could be sufficiently secure that they may permit some moves toward inclusive economic institutions when they are fairly certain that this will not threaten their political power. Alternatively, the historical situation could be such as to endow an extractive political regime with rather inclusive economic institutions, which they decide not to block. These provide the second way in which growth can take place under extractive political institutions. The rapid industrialization of South Korea under General Park is an example. Park came to power via a military coup in 1961, but he did so in a society heavily supported by the United States and with an economy where economic institutions were essentially inclusive. Though Park's regime was authoritarian, it felt secure enough to promote economic growth, and in fact did so very actively, perhaps partly because the regime was not directly supported by extractive economic institutions. Differently from the Soviet Union, and most other cases of growth under extractive institutions, South Korea transitioned from extractive political institutions toward inclusive political institutions in the 1980s. This successful transition was due to a confluence of factors. By the 1970s, economic institutions in South Korea had become sufficiently inclusive so that they reduced one of the strong rationales for extractive political institutions. The economic elite had little to gain from their own or the military's dominance of politics. The relative equality of income in South Korea also meant that the elite had less to fear from pluralism and democracy. The key influence of the United States, particularly given the threat from North Korea, also meant that the strong democracy movement that challenged the military dictatorship could not be repressed for long. Though General Park's assassination in 1979 was followed by another military coup led by Chin Doo-hwan, Chin's chosen successor, Roh Tae-woo, initiated a process of political reforms that led to the consolidation of a pluralistic democracy after 1992. Of course, no transition of this sort took place in the Soviet Union. In consequence, Soviet growth ran out of steam, and the economy began to collapse in the 1980s, and then totally fell apart in the 1990s. Chinese economic growth today also has several commonalities with both the Soviet and South Korean experiences. While the early stages of Chinese growth were spearheaded by radical market reforms in the agricultural sector, reforms in the industrial sector have been more muted. Even today, the state and the Communist Party play a central role in deciding which sectors and which companies will receive additional capital and will expand in the process, making and breaking fortunes. As in the Soviet Union in its heyday, China is growing rapidly. But this is still growth under extractive institutions, under the control of the state, with little sign of a transition to inclusive political institutions. The fact that Chinese economic institutions are still far from fully inclusive also suggests that a South Korean-style transition is less likely, though of course not impossible. It is worth noting that political centralization is key to both ways in which growth under extractive political institutions can occur. Without some degree of political centralization, the planter elite in Barbados, Cuba, Haiti, and Jamaica would not have been able to keep law and order and defend their own assets and property. Without significant political centralization and a firm grip on political power, neither the South Korean military elites nor the Chinese Communist Party would have felt secure enough to manufacture significant economic reforms and still manage to cling to power. And without such centralization, the state in the Soviet Union or China could not have been able to coordinate economic activity, to channel resources toward high productivity areas. A major dividing line between extractive political institutions is therefore their degree of political centralization. Those without it, such as many in sub-Saharan Africa, will find it difficult to achieve even limited growth. Even though extractive institutions can generate some growth, they will usually not generate sustained economic growth, and certainly not the type of growth that is accompanied by creative destruction. When both political and economic institutions are extractive, the incentives will not be there for creative destruction and technological change. For a while, the state may be able to create rapid economic growth by allocating resources and people by fiat, but this process is intrinsically limited. When the limits are hit, growth stops, as it did in the Soviet Union in the 1970s. Even when the Soviets achieved rapid economic growth, there was little technological change in most of the economy. Though by pouring massive resources into the military, they were able to develop military technologies and even pull ahead of the United States in the space and nuclear race for a short while. But this growth without creative destruction and without broad-based technological innovation was not sustainable and came to an abrupt end. In addition, the arrangements that support economic growth under extractive political institutions are, by their nature, fragile. They can collapse or can be easily destroyed by the infighting that the extractive institutions themselves generate. In fact, extractive political and economic institutions create a general tendency for infighting because they lead to the concentration of wealth and power in the hands of a narrow elite. If another group can overwhelm and outmaneuver this elite and take control of the state, they will be the ones enjoying this wealth and power. Consequently, as our discussion of the collapse of the later Roman Empire and the Maya cities will illustrate, fighting to control the all-powerful state is always latent, and it will periodically intensify and bring the undoing of these regimes as it turns into civil war, and sometimes into total breakdown and collapse of the state. One implication of this is that even if a society under extractive institutions initially achieves some degree of state centralization, it will not last. In fact, the infighting to take control of extractive institutions often leads to civil wars and widespread lawlessness, enshrining a persistent absence of state centralization, as in many nations in sub-Saharan Africa, and some in Latin America and South Asia. Finally, when growth comes under extractive political institutions, but where economic institutions have inclusive aspects, as they did in South Korea, there is always the danger that economic institutions become more extractive and growth stops. Those controlling political power will eventually find it more beneficial to use their power to limit competition, to increase their share of the pie, or even to steal and loot from others rather than support economic progress. The distribution and ability to exercise power will ultimately undermine the very foundations of economic prosperity, unless political institutions are transformed from extractive to inclusive. Chapter 4. Small Differences and Critical Junctures. The Weight of History. The World the Plague Created. In 1346, the bubonic plague, the Black Death, reached the port city of Tana at the mouth of the River Don on the Black Sea. Transmitted by fleas living on rats, the plague was brought from China by traders traveling along the Silk Road, the great trans-Asian commercial artery. Thanks to Genoese traders, the rats were soon spreading the fleas and the plague from Tana to the entire Mediterranean. By early 1347, the plague had reached Constantinople. In the spring of 1348, it was spreading through France and North Africa and up the boot of Italy. The plague wiped out about half of the population of any area it hit. Its arrival in the Italian city of Florence was witnessed firsthand by the Italian writer Giovanni Boccaccio. He later recalled, "In the face of its onrush, all the wisdom and ingenuity of man were unavailing. The plague began in a terrifying and extraordinary manner to make its disastrous effects apparent. It did not take the form it had assumed in the East, where if anyone bled from the nose, it was an obvious portent of certain death. On the contrary, its earliest symptom was the appearance of certain swellings in the groin or armpit, some of which were egg-shaped, whilst others were roughly the size of a common apple. Later on, the symptoms of the disease changed, and many people began to find dark blotches and bruises on their arms, thighs, and other parts of their bodies. Against these maladies, all the advice of physicians and all the power of medicine were profitless and unavailing, and in most cases, death occurred within 3 days from the appearance of the symptoms we have described." People in England knew the plague was coming their way and were well aware of impending doom. In mid-August 1348, King Edward III asked the Archbishop of Canterbury to organize prayers, and many bishops wrote letters for priests to read out in church to help people cope with what was about to hit them. Ralph of Shrewsbury, Bishop of Bath, wrote to his priests, "Almighty God uses thunder, lightning, and other blows which issue from his throne to scourge the sons whom he wishes to redeem. Accordingly, since a catastrophic pestilence from the east has arrived in a neighboring kingdom, it is to be very much feared that, unless we pray devoutly and incessantly, a similar pestilence will stretch its poisonous branches into this realm and strike down and consume the inhabitants. Therefore, we must all come before the presence of the Lord in confession, reciting psalms." It didn't do any good. The plague hit and quickly wiped out about half the English population. Such catastrophes can have a huge effect on the institutions of society. Perhaps understandably, scores of people went mad. Boccaccio noted that some maintained that an infallible way of warding off this appalling evil was to drink heavily, enjoy life to the full, go round singing and merrymaking, gratify all one's cravings whenever the opportunity offered, and shrugged the thing off as an enormous joke. And this explains why those women who recovered were possibly less chaste in the period that followed. Yet the plague also had a socially, economically, and politically transformative impact on medieval European societies. At the turn of the 14th century, Europe had a feudal order, an organization of society that first emerged in Western Europe after the collapse of the Roman Empire. It was based on a hierarchical relationship between the king and the lords beneath him, with the peasants at the bottom. The king owned the land, and he granted it to the lords in exchange for military services. The lords then allocated land to peasants, in exchange for which peasants had to perform extensive unpaid labor and were subject to many fines and taxes. Peasants, who, because of their servile status, were thus called serfs, were tied to the land, unable to move elsewhere without the permission of their lord, who was not just a landlord, but also the judge, jury, and police force. It was a highly extractive system, with wealth flowing upward from the many peasants to the few lords. The massive scarcity of labor created by the plague shook the foundations of the feudal order. It encouraged peasants to demand that things change. At Ensham Abbey, for example, the peasants demanded that many of the fines and unpaid labor be reduced. They got what they wanted, and their new contract began with the assertion, "At the time of the mortality or pestilence, which occurred in 1349, scarcely two tenants remained in the manor, and they expressed their intention of leaving unless Brother Nicholas of Upton, then abbot and lord of the manor, made a new agreement with them." He did. What happened at Ensham happened everywhere. Peasants started to free themselves from compulsory labor services and many obligations to their lords. Wages started to rise. The government tried to put a stop to this, and in 1351 passed the Statute of Laborers, which commenced, "Because a great part of the people, and especially of the workmen and servants, has now died in that pestilence, some, seeing the straits of the masters and the scarcity of servants, are not willing to serve unless they receive excessive wages. We, considering the grave inconveniences which might come from the lack especially of plowmen and such laborers, have seen fit to ordain that every man and woman of our kingdom of England shall be bound to serve him who has seen fit so to seek after him, and he shall take only the wages liveries, meed or salary, which, in the places where he sought to serve, were accustomed to be paid in the 20th year of our reign of England." King Edward III came to the throne on January 25, 1327, so the reference here is to 1347, or the 5 or 6 common years next preceding. The statute, in effect, tried to fix wages at the levels paid before the Black Death. Particularly concerning for the English elite was enticement, the attempt by one lord to attract the scarce peasants of another. The solution was to make prison the punishment for leaving employment without permission of the employer. "And if a reaper or mower or other workman or servant, of whatever standing or condition he be, who is retained in the service of any one, do depart from the said service before the end of the term agreed, without permission or reasonable cause, he shall undergo the penalty of imprisonment, and let no one, moreover, pay or permit to be paid to anyone more wages, livery, meed, or salary than was customary, as has been said." The attempt by the English state to stop the changes of institutions and wages that came in the wake of the Black Death didn't work. In 1381, the peasants' revolt broke out, and the rebels, under the leadership of Wat Tyler, even captured most of London. Though they were ultimately defeated, and Tyler was executed, there were no more attempts to enforce the Statute of Laborers. Feudal labor services dwindled away, an inclusive labor market began to emerge in England, and wages rose. The plague seems to have hit most of the world, and everywhere a similar fraction of the population perished. Thus, the demographic impact in Eastern Europe was the same as in England and Western Europe. The social and economic forces at play were also the same. Labor was scarce, and people demanded greater freedoms. But in the East, a more powerful contradictory logic was at work. Fewer people meant higher wages in an inclusive labor market. But this gave lords a greater incentive to keep the labor market extractive and the peasants servile. In England, this motivation had been in play too, as reflected in the Statute of Laborers. but workers had sufficient power that they got their way. Not so in Eastern Europe. After the plague, Eastern landlords started to take over large tracts of land and expand their holdings, which were already larger than those in Western Europe. Towns were weaker and less populous, and rather than becoming freer, workers began to see their already existing freedoms encroached on. The effects became especially clear after 1500, when Western Europe began to demand the agricultural goods, such as wheat, rye, and livestock, produced in the East. 80% of the imports of rye into Amsterdam came from the Elbe, Vistula, and Oder river valleys. Soon, half of the Netherlands' booming trade was with Eastern Europe. As Western demand expanded, Eastern landlords ratcheted up their control over the labor force to expand their supply. It was to be called the Second Serfdom, distinct and more intense than its original form of the early Middle Ages. Lords increased the taxes they levied on their tenants' own plots and took half of the gross output. In Korczyn, Poland, all work for the lord in 1533 was paid, but by 1600, nearly half was unpaid forced labor. In 1500, workers in Mecklenburg, in eastern Germany, owed only a few days unpaid labor services a year. By 1550, it was one day a week, and by 1600, 3 days per week. Workers' children had to work for the lord for free for several years. In Hungary, landlords took complete control of the land in 1514, legislating one day a week of unpaid labor services for each worker. In 1550, this was raised to 2 days per week. By the end of the century, it was 3 days. Serfs subject to these rules made up 90% of the rural population by this time. Though in 1346 there were few differences between Western and Eastern Europe in terms of political and economic institutions, by 1600 they were worlds apart. In the West, workers were free of feudal dues, fines, and regulations, and were becoming a key part of a booming market economy. In the East, they were also involved in such an economy, but as coerced serfs, growing the food and agricultural goods demanded in the West. It was a market economy, but not an inclusive one. This institutional divergence was the result of a situation where the differences between these areas initially seemed very small. In the East, lords were a little better organized. They had slightly more rights and more consolidated land holdings. Towns were weaker and smaller. Peasants less organized. In the grand scheme of history, these were small differences. Yet these small differences between the East and the West became very consequential for the lives of their populations and for the future path of institutional development when the feudal order was shaken up by the Black Death. The Black Death is a vivid example of a critical juncture, a major event or confluence of factors disrupting the existing economic or political balance in society. A critical juncture is a double-edged sword that can cause a sharp turn in the trajectory of a nation. On the one hand, it can open the way for breaking the cycle of extractive institutions and enable more inclusive ones to emerge, as in England. Or it can intensify the emergence of extractive institutions, as was the case with the Second Serfdom in Eastern Europe. Understanding how history and critical junctures shape the path of economic and political institutions enables us to have a more complete theory of the origins of differences in poverty and prosperity. In addition, it enables us to account for the lay of the land today and why some nations make the transition to inclusive economic and political institutions, while others do not. The making of inclusive institutions. England was unique among nations when it made the breakthrough to sustained economic growth in the 17th century. Major economic changes were preceded by a political revolution that brought a distinct set of economic and political institutions, much more inclusive than those of any previous society. These institutions would have profound implications, not only for economic incentives and prosperity, but also for who would reap the benefits of prosperity. They were based not on consensus, but rather were the result of intense conflict as different groups competed for power, contesting the authority of others and attempting to structure institutions in their own favor. The culmination of the institutional struggles of the 16th and 17th centuries were two landmark events. The English Civil War between 1642 and 1651, and particularly the Glorious Revolution of 1688. The Glorious Revolution limited the power of the king and the executive, and relocated to Parliament the power to determine economic institutions. At the same time, it opened up the political system to a broad cross-section of society, who were able to exert considerable influence over the way the state functioned. The Glorious Revolution was the foundation for creating a pluralistic society, and it built on and accelerated a process of political centralization. It created the world's first set of inclusive political institutions. As a consequence, economic institutions also started becoming more inclusive. Neither slavery nor the severe economic restrictions of the feudal medieval period, such as serfdom, existed in England at the beginning of the 17th century. Nevertheless, there were many restrictions on economic activities people could engage in. Both the domestic and international economy were choked by monopolies. The state engaged in arbitrary taxation and manipulated the legal system. Most land was caught in archaic forms of property rights that made it impossible to sell and risky to invest in. This changed after the Glorious Revolution. The government adopted a set of economic institutions that provided incentives for investment, trade, and innovation. It steadfastly enforced property rights, including patents granting property rights for ideas, thereby providing a major stimulus to innovation. It protected law and order. Historically unprecedented was the application of English law to all citizens. Arbitrary taxation ceased, and monopolies were abolished almost completely. The English state aggressively promoted mercantile activities and worked to promote domestic industry, not only by removing barriers to the expansion of industrial activity, but also by lending the full power of the English Navy to defend mercantile interests. By rationalizing property rights, it facilitated the construction of infrastructure, particularly roads, canals, and later railways, that would prove to be crucial for industrial growth. These foundations decisively changed incentives for people and impelled the engines of prosperity, paving the way for the Industrial Revolution. First and foremost, the Industrial Revolution depended on major technological advances exploiting the knowledge base that had accumulated in Europe during the past centuries. It was a radical break from the past, made possible by scientific inquiry and the talents of a number of unique individuals. The full force of this revolution came from the market that created profitable opportunities for technologies to be developed and applied. It was the inclusive nature of markets that allowed people to allocate their talents to the right lines of business. It also relied on education and skills, for it was the relatively high levels of education, at least by the standards of the time, that enabled the emergence of entrepreneurs with the vision to employ new technologies for their businesses and to find workers with the skills to use them. It is not a coincidence that the Industrial Revolution started in England a few decades following the Glorious Revolution. The great inventors such as James Watt, perfecter of the steam engine, Richard Trevithick, the builder of the first steam locomotive, Richard Arkwright, the inventor of the spinning frame, and Isambard Kingdom Brunel, the creator of several revolutionary steamships, were able to take up the economic opportunities generated by their ideas, were confident that their property rights would be respected, and had access to markets where their innovations could be profitably sold and used. In 1775, just after he had the patent renewed on his steam engine, which he called his fire engine, James Watt wrote to his father, "Dear Father, after a series of various and violent oppositions, I have at last got an act of Parliament vesting the property of my new fire engines in me and my assigns throughout Great Britain and the plantations for 25 years to come, which I hope will be very beneficial to me, as there is already considerable demand for them." This letter reveals two things. First, Watt was motivated by the market opportunities he anticipated, by the considerable demand in Great Britain and its plantations, the English overseas colonies. Second, it shows how he was able to influence Parliament to get what he wanted, since it was responsive to the appeals of individuals and innovators. The technological advances, the drive of businesses to expand and invest, and the efficient use of skills and talent were all made possible by the inclusive economic institutions that England developed. These, in turn, were founded on her inclusive political institutions. England developed these inclusive political institutions because of two factors. First were political institutions, including a centralized state, that enabled her to take the next radical, in fact unprecedented, step toward inclusive institutions with the onset of the Glorious Revolution. While this factor distinguished England from much of the world, it did not significantly differentiate it from Western European countries such as France and Spain. More important was the second factor. The events leading up to the Glorious Revolution forged a broad and powerful coalition, able to place durable constraints on the power of the monarchy and the executive, which were forced to be open to the demands of this coalition. This laid the foundations for pluralistic political institutions, which then enabled the development of economic institutions that would underpin the first industrial revolution. Small differences that matter. World inequality dramatically increased with the British or English Industrial Revolution, because only some parts of the world adopted the innovations and new technologies that men such as Arkwright and Watt, and the many who followed, developed. The response of different nations to this wave of technologies, which determined whether they would languish in poverty or achieve sustained economic growth, was largely shaped by the different historical paths of their institutions. By the middle of the 18th century, there were already notable differences in political and economic institutions around the world. But where did these differences come from? English political institutions were on their way to much greater pluralism by 1688, compared with those in France and Spain. But if we go back in time 100 years to 1588, the differences shrink to almost nothing. All three countries were ruled by relatively absolutist monarchs, Elizabeth I in England, Philip II in Spain, and Henry II in France. All were battling with assemblies of citizens, such as the Parliament in England, the Cortes in Spain, and the Estates General in France, that were demanding more rights and control over the monarchy. These assemblies all had somewhat different powers and scopes. For instance, the English Parliament and the Spanish Cortes had power over taxation, while the Estates General did not. In Spain, this mattered little, because after 1492, the Spanish crown had a vast American empire and benefited massively from the gold and silver found there. In England, the situation was different. Elizabeth I was far less financially independent, so she had to beg Parliament for more taxes. In exchange, Parliament demanded concessions, in particular, restrictions on the right of Elizabeth to create monopolies. It was a conflict Parliament gradually won. In Spain, the Cortes lost a similar conflict. Trade wasn't just monopolized, it was monopolized by the Spanish monarchy. These distinctions, which initially appeared small, started to matter a great deal in the 17th century. Though the Americas had been discovered by 1492 and Vasco da Gama had reached India by rounding the Cape of Good Hope at the southern tip of Africa in 1498, it was only after 1600 that a huge expansion of world trade, particularly in the Atlantic, started to take place. In 1585, the first English colonization of North America began at Roanoke, in what is now North Carolina. In 1600, the English East India Company was formed. In 1602, it was followed by the Dutch equivalent. In 1607, the colony of Jamestown was founded by the Virginia Company. By the 1620s, the Caribbean was being colonized, with Barbados occupied in 1627. France was also expanding in the Atlantic, founding Quebec City in 1608 as the capital of New France in what is now Canada. The consequences of this economic expansion for institutions were very different for England than for Spain and France because of small initial differences. Elizabeth I and her successors could not monopolize the trade with the Americas. Other European monarchs could. So while in England, Atlantic trade and colonization started creating a large group of wealthy traders with few links to the crown. This was not the case in Spain or France. The English traders resented royal control and demanded changes in political institutions and the restriction of royal prerogatives. They played a critical role in the English Civil War and the Glorious Revolution. Similar conflicts took place everywhere. French kings, for example, faced the Fronde Rebellion between 1648 and 1652. The difference was that in England, it was far more likely that the opponents to absolutism would prevail, because they were relatively wealthy and more numerous than the opponents to absolutism in Spain and France. The divergent paths of English, French, and Spanish societies in the 17th century illustrate the importance of the interplay of small institutional differences with critical junctures. During critical junctures, a major event or confluence of factors disrupts the existing balance of political or economic power in a nation. These can affect only a single country, such as the death of Chairman Mao Zedong in 1976, which at first created a critical juncture only for Communist China. Often, however, critical junctures affect a whole set of societies, in the way that, for example, colonization and then decolonization affected most of the globe. Such critical junctures are important because there are formidable barriers against gradual improvements, resulting from the synergy between extractive political and economic institutions and the support they give each other. The persistence of this feedback loop creates a vicious circle. Those who benefit from the status quo are wealthy and well-organized, and can effectively fight major changes that will take away their economic privileges and political power. Once a critical juncture happens, the small differences that matter are the initial institutional differences that put in motion very different responses. This is the reason why the relatively small institutional differences in England, France, and Spain led to fundamentally different development paths. The paths resulted from the critical juncture created by the economic opportunities presented to Europeans by Atlantic trade. Even if small institutional differences matter greatly during critical junctures, not all institutional differences are small, and naturally, larger institutional differences lead to even more divergent patterns during such junctures. While the institutional differences between England and France were small in 1588, the differences between Western and Eastern Europe were much greater. In the West, strong centralized states such as England, France, and Spain had latent constitutional institutions, Parliament, the Estate General, and the Cortes. There were also underlying similarities in economic institutions, such as the lack of serfdom. Eastern Europe was a different matter. The Kingdom of Poland-Lithuania, for example, was ruled by an elite class called the Szlachta, who were so powerful they had even introduced elections for kings. This was not absolute rule, as in France under Louis XIV, the Sun King, but absolutism of an elite, extractive political institution all the same. The Szlachta ruled over a mostly rural society dominated by serfs, who had no freedom of movement or economic opportunities. Farther east, the Russian Emperor Peter the Great was also consolidating an absolutism far more intense and extractive than even Louis XIV could manage. Map 8 provides one simple way of seeing the extent of the divergence between Western and Eastern Europe at the beginning of the 19th century. It plots whether or not a country still had serfdom in 1800. Countries that appear dark did. Those that are light did not. Eastern Europe is dark. Western Europe is light. Yet the institutions of Western Europe had not always been so different from those in the East. They began, as we saw earlier, to diverge in the 14th century when the Black Death hit in 1346. There were small differences between political and economic institutions in Western and Eastern Europe. England and Hungary were even ruled by members of the same family, the Angevins. The more important institutional differences that emerged after the Black Death then created the background upon which the more significant divergence between the East and the West would play out during the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries. But where do the small institutional differences that start this process of divergence arise in the first place? Why did Eastern Europe have different political and economic institutions than the West in the 14th century? Why was the balance of power between crown and parliament different in England than in France and Spain? As we will see in the next chapter, even societies that are far less complex than our modern society create political and economic institutions that have powerful effects on the lives of their members. This is true even for hunter-gatherers, as we know from surviving societies such as the San people of modern Botswana, who do not farm or even live in permanent settlements. No two societies create the same institutions. They will have distinct customs, different systems of property rights, and different ways of dividing a killed animal or loot stolen from another group. Some will recognize the authority of elders, others will not. Some will achieve some degree of political centralization early on, others will not. Societies are constantly subject to